Welcome back to Gulf Coast Live. I'm Mike Kinnairy. Most scientists and pediatricians assumed that brain growth was basically complete by the time a child started kindergarten. But over the past decade or so, neurology and neuropsychology research has shown that the teen years encompass vitally important stages of brain development. For the rest of the hour, we're going to listen back to a conversation I had with neurologist Dr. Frances Jensen about her best-selling novel that explores this research and its implications, The Teenage Brain, A Neuroscientist's Survival Guide to Raising Adolescents and Young Adults. Let's hear that conversation now. Dr. Jensen is professor and chair of the Department of Neurology at the Perelman School of Medicine at University of Pennsylvania. She was a professor of neurology at Harvard Medical School and director of translational neuroscience and director of epilepsy research at Boston Children's Hospital, among other stops along her career. Frances Jensen, welcome to Gulf Coast Live, and thank you for your time.
Great to be here. Thank you.
Do you have a teenage brain in your house, or maybe you're about to? If you'd like to ask Dr. Jensen a question or make a comment, give us a call now at 877-428-8255. That's 877-GCU-TALK. On Facebook, we're at WGCU Public Media. On Twitter, we're at WGCU using the hashtag GCL. So why did you decide to write this book?
Well, it came out of my personal life. So while I'm a neurologist and I was a neuroscientist studying brain development, as you pointed out, looking at epilepsy and early childhood brain diseases, I actually recognized I had an experiment going on in my own home, which was my two teenage sons, which were morphing in front of me. So that led me – I felt I was very well equipped to try to understand what was going on with these kids. And I delved into the literature and also looked at some of the results in our laboratory, but mostly delving into the literature to understand what was going on. And this was back in sort of late 2000s, so right around 2010, 11, the basis of the research on teenage brain was just beginning. It had been a very neglected area for all the reasons you said. And what has actually caused it to come alive and now it's exploding is the advent of human-based studies, largely this neuroimaging, magnetic resonance imaging, MRIs.
So improvements in scans of brains.
Yeah, and we can watch people doing tasks and, at rest, at sleep, and in tasks and watch how their brains work while they're making decisions, et cetera. And that led over the last literally 10 to 15 years, completely new understanding that the brain does not stop developing until well into your 20s, probably up to around 30, and that actually there are even still changes that happen beyond then. But the bulk of it is done by mid to late 20s. So really, teenagers are far from adults with fewer miles on them.
So what kind of things are going on in an adolescent brain that we've learned that we weren't aware of before?
Yeah. So there's a lot of good news. So one of my things I just want to say here is that I think adolescents, teenagers kind of get a bad rap in society. And everybody, makes an assumption that they're sort of malevolent, up to no good, troublemakers, et cetera. And that's not the case. What's happening in their brains are they're in the middle of a stage in their brains where they're novelty seeking. It's a natural part of brain development. So what's happening is they're taking risks. And that's, of course, what society sees obviously
right.
in a very negative light. But it is part of the process of brain development. We can talk about why that is in a minute. But the other really amazing thing that's happening in the teenage years is a continuation of what was happening in childhood, which is the ability to learn. Now, everybody I'm sure that's listening to this can relate to the fact they know that, especially when you have friends that are, multiple languages being used in the home, how children in those families just absorb the languages,
right.
learn two and three languages absolutely, rapidly compared to adults. Well, this is because they actually have more of the components in their brain to learn. So we have brain cells called neurons, and the neurons are talking to each other through connection points called synapses.
Mm-hmm.
We have about 100 billion neurons in our brain and about 100 trillion connection points. But you start off you make a lot more than you need later in life, early in life.
Okay.
So there, you're able to also build them with experience. And so we call that plasticity, synaptic plasticity, meaning you're molding these connections and adding and subtracting them based on how much you're using them,
mm-hmm.
sort of use it or lose it.
Yeah, yeah.
So children have all the machinery for this, is developmentally, genetically built at higher levels through childhood. And it's still high coming through adolescence into adulthood, so into the sort of mid-20s. This is why – and so adolescents need to know that they can learn faster than they ever will again. So they have like this hidden strength, which can turn out also to be a risk because they can learn bad things as well as good things.
Right,
of course.
Right. They can learn quickly, but they need to learn the right things, or I guess. You know, I have a 13 3/4-year-old, and I've watched her. You know, these kids now with access to YouTube and whatnot, and it applies to us adults to some degree too. You can go from zero knowledge to lots of knowledge very quickly. And so, like, you know, she picked up the ukulele 4 months ago, and now she can play 20 songs with her eyes closed. And it's just like, holy cow.
And who do you go to when your computer's not working or your phone's not working?
Yeah, right.
You go straight to her. And if she doesn't know it, I bet you she learns it in, you know, a few minutes by looking up things. So the part that I was talking about, the risk-taking, they're seemingly sometimes unfavorable behavior, shall we say,
yeah.
Comes from the fact that we as adults, we kind of often gate our behavior. We realize that we shouldn't do something that's inappropriate, or we shouldn't do that. We know about the consequence of doing something very risky. And what that is, it's your frontal lobe, which is the part of your brain that's the executive function part of your brain.
Mm-hmm.
It controls risk-taking and it prevents, you know, too much of too much bad exploratory behavior, if you will, and judgment is in the frontal lobes, and the brain needs to take time to connect the frontal lobes fully. So the brain actually connects itself. We have all these different parts of our brain that are sectioned off that do different tasks, from movement to sensation to hearing to vision. And the frontal lobe is in the front, and that's the decision-making part of your brain. And the back, your brain connects itself sort of from the back to the front. So the most elemental things, basic function, breathing, eating, are handled first before you're even born. But over these, the course of your childhood and adolescent life, you're slowly connecting forward to your frontal lobe. And that's what they don't have full access to. So, but meanwhile, they do have a part of your brain that does, that's emotionality, sexual urges, all these things, which is called your temporal lobe or limbic system.
Yeah.
That's already connected.
So the parts of the brain are all developing like gangbusters, but they're not being connected until later.
You bet.
They're still acting using those parts that are disconnected.
Their parts that are connected are functioning without the regulation of the frontal lobe.
I see. So, yeah, they've got an engine with no steering wheel.
We call it a Ferrari with weak brakes.
Okay. Is there any fundamental difference between boys and girls during the teenage years when it comes to where these developments are occurring and connections are happening?
Yeah. So there are now – literature is emerging to suggest that broadly there are some differences between genders. But again, this is, again, like looking at whole populations. Individuals, they're, you know, you have to look at it on an individual basis. But in general, it is looking like the boys develop these connections, and also past this peak in plasticity that I'm talking about happens about 2 years after girls for a chronological – so girls at a chronological age are 2 years closer to the end point than boys are for their maturation. So there is a bit of boys lagging behind girls. And I think sometimes we see this in the middle of high school, you know, who's organizing all the social events and
yeah.
who actually remembers the books for their exams and whatnot. We can see elements of this. But again, there are many early boys and late girls, of course.
Hmm. I'm talking to Dr. Frances Jensen. She's author of the best-selling book, The Teenage Brain, A Neuroscientist's Survival Guide to Raising Adolescents and Young Adults, that explores research into just what's happening in adolescent brains as they develop. If you'd like to add your voice to our conversation, give us a call now at 877-428-8255. That's 877-GCU-TALK. So what are the techniques, and you alluded to this earlier, the technologies that have come along in the past 10 to 15 years that have made these advances possible? It's brain scanning. What are the actual tools that you guys are using?
So we're learning a lot about a lot of the early research was, of course, done looking at other species, right? And now we have the capacity to sort of link up that basic cellular and molecular knowledge that was coming from looking at animal development, which is similarly takes a while into, you know, the version of adolescence for animals as well. But what we're learning from the magnetic resonance imaging, which has been applied very broadly now to look at the absolute fine-tuned structure of the brain, so we can watch these connections develop that I'm talking about. If you scan scan people at different ages, but you could also watch them during tasks. So,
in real time,
in
like
real
you're watching
time.
A video.
Exactly.
Right, right.
So here's an example of it to go back to our point of their kind of running with their emotional parts of their brain extremely active, actually more active than they will be in adulthood because they don't have the frontal lobes sort of dampening back, you know, sending signals back going, bad idea, don't do that. So what has been you know, we all realize that adolescents can be very emotionally labile, you know.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And why is that? Well, there's real science behind that. And I think as a parent or teachers or people around adolescents, we have to show a little empathy and understand actually what is actually going on in the brain and why they actually respond to the most trivial of things as if it was an international incident. And what that is their brain part that is the limbic system, which is it's turned on by stress and fear and, you know, emotionality. If you're tracking that and comparing and exposing, say, a teenager to some scary looking pictures, and there have been studies that have done this, sort of concerning looking faces, for instance, and compare them to children and adults looking at the exact same faces, you will see that emotional part of the brain light up 2 to 3 fold compared to the children and compared to the adults.
Mm.
And the reason that the adults are dampening their message and the children haven't really connected up that area yet. So we really are looking at the biology behind why, you know, your daughter may come home in tears from, you know, you're like, that's not a big deal. For her brain, it is actually to her brain responding like it was an international incident.
So the brain scans are saying, give your kids a little slack, parents.
Yes, it's say understand, you know, that don't the my feeling that I've said, and I said this when I wrote the book, and I say it when I give talks, is just, you know, count to 10, recognize that it's sort of an awesome biology playing itself out in front of you, and that there's actually some neurobiology behind this behavior you consider incredibly aberrant and absurd, but it isn't for them. So that's an example of how that kind of functional imaging has really given us a lot of biological insight into behavior.
Is there a next generation of brain scanning that is being developed that you guys kind of see coming down the road, and what are the implications of it if there is something?
Well, you know, it's the magnetic resonance imaging devices are getting more and more high resolution. So we're seeing everything in, you know, down to practically not, you know, clumps of cells you can almost see now in microns, you know, you're able to visualize. So we're going to be able to understand the micro networks that are involved in these behaviors as well. So that's one thing. The other is developing better techniques of deciphering all this connectivity that's happening in the brain. So this is being used in psychiatry a lot too. So, you know, psychiatric disorders, because most – unlike neurology where a lot of the diseases we see have parts of your brain that have an injury in them or a stroke and you can actually see these things, a lot of psychiatric disorders are very serious brain disorders. But when you look at an MRI, just a plain MRI, it looks perfectly normal. So these functional MRIs are beginning to show that some things aren't quite connected up the way they are in other parts of the population and some of the psychiatric disorders. So we're really seeing that. And speaking of psychiatric disorders, what we're discovering is we know historically, this has been known for hundreds of years, that many psychiatric disorders come on late in teen years. In fact, about 75% of, you know, major affective disorders like bipolar, depression, schizophrenia have their onset in late teens and into early adulthood. And interestingly, what has been now appreciated is that this is a developmental event. Their brains couldn't actually do these diseases in early childhood. You need to have at least part of your frontal lobe connected, but probably not connected quite right back to the rest of your brain. And so we're beginning to see like the emergence of being able to diagnose people earlier and earlier with maybe a prodrome for one of these diseases. So as I said, 75% of people who have psychiatric disorders have their onset between about 15 and 26. And actually 1 in 4 people in our society have some form of psychiatric disorder, be it from mild anxiety to one of these more serious conditions. So, you know, this is a big burden to society and to all of us that that imaging is going to really, I think, help us work on and see when we have a treatment effect. You know, it's going to be really bright future, I think.
That's fascinating. What does the neuroscientists have to say about multitasking. You know, we now all multitask in ways that we never did before, and the hope seems to be that the digital natives will be able to do it better or more naturally, or their brains will wire in a way that it makes sense. But what is your perspective, and what are the scans showing us?
Yeah, so what we're seeing is actually this is, again, not 100% flushed out yet. All of this research I'm talking about is really quite new. So what I put in the book I know is reliable, reproducible. But there's a lot of cool stuff coming out again. And when I write the next version of my book, I'll have even more to write about. But what we're learning is just basically when you observe these teenagers, we know that they are much more facile at like texting and doing multiple tasks. It's a learned behavior. So I said their learning is better, so they are able to learn these things. However, when you do studies to look at the rate of learning on a single task and you compare somebody who has distracted attention at encoding, which means taking in the memory, trying to memorize it, or distracted attention at recall, which means like if you're cranking it out for a test, you know, at the time you're being questioned, they will not do as well, even this generation, as if you had no distractions during the encoding and recall process. So what we do know is that the brain is best at learning a single thing in a single time, but we can manage distraction, and they're doing it better than we are, but it's not as good as they could be. So what I used to say to my kids, and I'm like, you know, I understand you want to have, you know, a whole bunch of text going on and the music on, you know, video in the background and also study your Shakespeare. But if you really want to do this most efficiently, do it as a one-on-one, you know, activity. So I think that's very helpful. But what we're learning about multitasking and task switching using this functional MRI is quite interesting. The research that I was able to find seems to be showing that – remember I said that the brain continues to you know, cause these connections to develop over into your adulthood? It looks like probably the mid-30s is the sweet spot for the most efficient ability to be on task, be distracted, and go right back to it. Mm. They are better than younger, and they're better than older people. So it's very interesting.
Hmm. Where does sleep fit into this equation for kids?
Yes, so sleep. We know that teenagers, you know, are the ones to be found, you know, asleep at mid-morning, you know, and people can't wake them up. And it's not because they're just trying to be lazy. It's a real thing. Their sleep cycle, and in fact, most mammalian species have this same shift during late adolescence into very early adulthood of just going to bed later and later. Why is that? And they do need 8 to 9 hours at least of sleep a night. So they've got to fit that in. So what it is melatonin. A part of your brain releases melatonin, the same stuff you can buy at the, you know, drugstore for jet lag. But you release your own version of it. And that, within about an hour and a half, makes your brain want to go to sleep. The part of the brain that does this, we do that about 8:45 or 9 o'clock in adults. But in teenagers, it's not going out to about 11 o'clock plus at night. So they aren't even ready to fall asleep until midnight. And so if they're distracting themselves with all these other, you know, blue light devices and whatnot, it's going to make it even harder for them. And yet they need to wake up. So one of the issues is we're waking them up at 6 a.m. And it's like waking an adult up at 3 a.m. And they're not functioning. We're doing them an injustice. And a lot of schools have started to move the day later, you know, start times. Yeah. And I think that, you know, works for the teenage brain.
Our high schools here start at 7 or 7:10, I think. And I was going to bring up, we don't think we're going to have time, but there's a study that showed like a school district moved the school time back, and the school district next door didn't, and there was a reduction in car accidents in the one district, even from an hour
change. There's also studies done on these night owl types, because not all teenagers are like this, but the ones that are, they do much better in when they're test if they take an exam at midday or early afternoon compared to 8 or 9 in the morning.
Hmm. Let's take a call from Robert in Port Charlotte. Robert, welcome to Gulf Coast Live. What have you got?
Hey, thank you so much for taking the call. It's a real maybe I'm a 71-year-old guy who's studied a lot of this for a long time, but the issue for me is Abraham S. Maslow talked about a hierarchy of needs, and my question is simply this: nature or nurture? When you're at the survival mode, does it affect brain development for young people?
Well, that's been a very hotly debated area, and it's a great thing. So the synaptic plasticity I'm talking about is it's kind of a use it or lose it. So, you know, if you're a musician, you build bigger areas in your brain, in the music areas, the areas of the brain that would control your ability to play the piano, than somebody who didn't. And somebody who is a golf player will be developing different parts of their brain. And you literally will see the maps of these parts of your body or parts of your association cortex increase during those tasks. And so part of that, that's definitely nurture, right? But the nature part is you have to have your constitutive synaptic makeup to start with. And that is, in fact, genetically, you know, there's a huge genetic influence. So I have to say it's nature and nurture. The one thing we know we can control in this life is the nurture part. So I think we need to get on the bandwagon and think about how, you know, our and we know this in early enrichment programs in children do wonders. And what I am trying to say to school districts for adolescents is that's another critical period. We call them critical periods of development. And that's – we're maybe underestimating the ability for a brain to turn around from somebody that isn't doing very well scholastically, for instance, or has a learning issue. This is the time to turn it around and really work on those weaknesses and work on the strengths, because they'll never have that level of synaptic plasticity again. So I think for high school and even into college, we have to realize this is a very dynamic place where nurture can really take advantage of the best of nature.
All right, Robert, thanks for the input.
Thanks.
You know, does the educational system need to start taking all of these things into consideration in terms of not just school start times, but the way teenage brains works and all the things you just said? And is that an uphill battle?
Well, you know, it's not as much. It's not an uphill battle, actually. The teachers are fascinated. And I've spoken to the National Science Teachers Association, and I always call teachers they're neuroscientists in the wild.
Right.
They're
yeah.
basically changing brains on an hourly basis in school. They're actually modifying your children's brains. And they're very interested in this. So I think there's a lot of issues around the ability to do individualized educational plans. We tend to only do it for people who are struggling in school. And frankly, I hope that one day that with our ability, with our apps and things, we will be able to actually get an individual educational plan for everybody, no matter if they're the best student or the worst student, because there are different learning styles. And somebody may be ahead in
kind
math
like,
and
like
behind in English.
Targeted medicine kind of.
Precision learning, precision education. I think, you know, in another decade or two, we won't be putting everybody into MRIs on their way through the school door, but we'll have apps that are known to correlate with things that we know from MRIs and probably be able to help people with that. So I think that's going to be very important. There are other issues around gender-based, curricula, if those might be useful in some circumstances as aids. And also this school start time thing. Plus, okay, the other part is just going to class is not the only way – that's not the only thing that's going to cause your brain to learn. You need to have two other things – well, three other. One is enough sleep. Second is exercise. We know that exercise at all ages enhances this process of building synapses and stabilizing them, which we call memory, right?
Mm-hmm.
And learning that I've just alluded to, building these synapses as you use them. And then and thirdly, this ability to have quiet time. And there's a lot of discussion now, we call it this default mode network of the brain needing time to sort of just be in its own internal rhythm, if you will. And it's concerning in that we have this frenetic life these days, just like we don't exercise. We have to set aside an hour for exercise. We may have to set an hour aside to have this relaxing time for our brain, which interestingly looks like meditation basically brings on.
Gotcha.
So after all these years, we now know what the Buddhists were doing, and there's real neurobiology, and it improves your ability to learn the next day.
Well, we are basically out of time, but my last question is, you started by saying you wrote this book because you had your teenage sons. Did this research, did you apply it as a parent?
I did. And they, it was a journey, as all teenagers, have. But at the end of the day, I'm very proud to say they're both in medical school, actually.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Brain
and
scientists?
One may become a brain scientist, actually.
Oh, cool.
Yeah.
Any advice from what you've learned that you've distilled down?
I would just like to say, before you jump to alienate your teen and use sharp language with them, use your frontal lobe. And remember as an adult that you have a frontal lobe and it is connected. So give them a frontal lobe assist from time to time. This means role modeling, decision making, if they're thinking about colleges, going through the pros and cons, even on everyday little things in at any age in the teenage, work with them and help guide them into making decisions and beginning to develop their abilities.
All right. Well, that is all the time we have for today's show. Thanks to my guest, Dr. Frances Jensen, is a neurologist and author of the best-selling book, The Teenage Brain, A Neuroscientist's Survival Guide to Raising Adolescents and Young Adults. Thank you for your time.
Thank you.
Our show today was produced by Julie Glenn and myself. Our director is Richard Chin Kui. Our social media coordinator is Tara Callaghan. Gulf Coast Live is made possible through the generous support of the Elizabeth B. McGraw Foundation. For now, thanks for listening. I'm Mike Canary. This is WGCU-FM, Fort Myers 90.1, WMKO Marco Island 91.7 FM, NPR for Southwest Florida.